not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we take another in-depth look at the contents of Censored 2017 and the latest research on everything from media propaganda to the police state. We'll have on the program today attorney Shohid Buttar. He's talking about Ike's dystopian dream and how it came true on surveillance in America. We're also going to be talking with co-host Peter Phillips about his contribution selling Empire, War, and Capitalism, public relations propaganda firms in service to the transnational capitalist class. We'll round out the program with a longer discussion about Project Censored research. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Our first guest on the program today is Shohid Buttar. He is a constitutional lawyer focused on the intersection of community organizing and policy reform as a lever to shift legal norms. He led the Bill of Rights Defense Committee from 2009 to 2015 and crafted the organization's platform for advancing transpartisan resistance to domestic surveillance and executive secrecy. Shohid Buttar is now working for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he was a contributor to Censored 2017, our 40th anniversary edition. Shohid wrote this chapter on his own behalf, not as part of his work at EFF, but Shohid wrote a chapter called Ike's Dystopian Dream and How It Came True. Shohid Buttar, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thanks for having me, Mickey.
Shohid, tell us about the chapter in Censored 2017. You're alluding to Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address. Tell us about this.
This was Ike's last message to the American people before he left the White House. And before occupying the White House, of course, he was the Supreme Allied Commander, the victorious military general who won World War II and beat the Nazis. And he was saying in his last address to the American people that he feared one of his signature accomplishments, and that was the creation of what he described as a military-industrial complex. Earlier versions of the speech included congressional and military-industrial complex. And the essence of his concern was that the profit motive, compelled with defense and public security, would threaten democracy in America. And we've seen that prediction unfortunately come true in a series of events and eras in American history that are rarely presented or considered through the lens of his connecting prediction.
Shohid, you hit a number of points in your chapter, which I found really an inspiring understanding of not only Eisenhower's warnings, but a summary of how that's manifested here in the U.S., including police militarization, CIA torture, the Patriot Act, a number of other things. Take us through that journey a little bit.
I appreciate that. And I think that that journey really starts not long after the era in which Ike was himself giving the warning. Remember, among his signature accomplishments was defeating Nazi Germany. And one of our nation's enduring legacies from that struggle was the international commitment to prohibit torture and human experimentation, which we have violated ourselves and continue to violate every day that we refuse to bring to justice the various officials who were culpable and complicit in torture. Remember the Nuremberg trials, which, I mean, obviously World War II was about a great many things and it led to a great many things, but the Nuremberg trials were in one way its legal culmination. And it stood for the principle that if you commit torture, it doesn't matter who gave you what orders. It doesn't matter if you thought there was a national security emergency. Torture is an international crime, full stop, you bear consequences. And that's exactly the principle, not that the Bush administration resigned, that's the principle that the Obama administration resigned by refusing to hold accountable the Bush administration and still in service CIA officials who committed international human rights abuses. Fast forward the tape from there, same agency, different theater. But when the CIA was destabilizing democratic leaders across the global South during the Cold War, that among other things, led in the 80s to the CIA's complicity in running drugs into the United States, which in turn prompted police militarization responding to what was essentially a CIA attack on the United States. Think about the way the police militarization has played out domestically, suppressing the dissent of communities that have long been subject to police violence by militarized police, taking us back again through a different vector to Eisenhower's warnings. And we see police departments clamoring to procure military equipment, training. You see the same kind of phenomenon of powers justified in a single setting. SWAT teams, for instance, were originally justified to deal with hostage and rescue situations, for instance, right? And now they're used routinely to execute drug warrants. Huge overuse. People get killed by SWAT teams raiding the wrong houses. And it's a perfect example of Ike's warning that the military-industrial complex, the profit motive plus public security or defense, would threaten rights and processes. And if you go forward past that, we get into the NSA's dragnet spying. That's a very direct manifestation of the military-industrial complex turning its fangs on the United States operationally. And I think the zenith of this very sordid saga is the CIA conducting espionage operations targeting the U.S. Senate to steal documents about the agency's human rights abuses, bringing us back full circle to Eisenhower in World War II.
Indeed. Shahid Buttar, let's run that gap for a moment. You write in Censored 2017 in your chapter, A Pattern and Practice, Abusing Constitutional Rights in Secret, and you talk a little bit about a history of COINTELPRO, a little bit of what we find out about the CIA through both the Church and Pike Commission. Could you run us through a quick history of that, and then we can focus on some of the post-9/11 manifestations of these abuses?
Sure. This is an era of U.S. history that even people who lived through it, I find, have largely, if not forgotten, forget about. And its implications for the issues that we're dealing with today are grave, but largely go overlooked. So this was for at least 40 years, starting in the 1950s through the 60s, into the 70s, and certain indicators would suggest continuing into the 80s and 90s, the FBI conducted a witch hunt targeting domestic political activists who were peacefully pursuing their constitutionally protected rights, not only to raise their voices and assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances, but also to speak to the rest of us, right? The First Amendment's not just the right to speak, it's also the right to hear. And we, as a society, were denied the right to hear from a series of social movements that the FBI viciously suppressed. And this is not a conspiracy theory. This is thoroughly documented by the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. It was the investigation into these FBI crimes that created the Senate and House intelligence committees that continue to exist, even if they have, for all intents and purposes, resigned their independence today. But the COINTELPRO era included a character assassination campaign targeting Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., one of our nation's greatest heroes. I just visited the African American History Museum in D.C., which, of course, pays a very compelling homage to him as a historical figure. There is a plaque on the side of one of the walls acknowledging COINTELPRO, which I found a disappointingly underwhelming depiction of a very relentless campaign that he was subjected to, not only to, and this is the FBI's word, neutralize Dr. King as a political threat to established powers, but also to drive him to suicide. And again, that's not my assertion. That is a finding of the U.S. Senate, which described COINTELPRO, this is also a quote, as a sophisticated vigilante operation. And just to be clear here, it didn't just target the civil rights movement. It targeted the movement to end the war in Vietnam. It targeted the movement for equal rights for women. It targeted the American Indian movement, it was described at the time. It targeted the movement for Puerto Rican independence. It targeted both the militant and the peaceful wings of the civil rights movement and Black Power movement. This was a broadly oppressive scheme using targeted surveillance to undermine constitutionally protected rights, the sort of rights that enable our democracy. So you can describe COINTELPRO in terms not unlike the CIA hacking the Senate, as a democracy undermining program of precisely the sort that Eisenhower warned us.
Certainly, Eisenhower's warning of militarization and the profits from that have crept right into our neighborhoods, not only with spying and the ability to listen to our cell phones by local police, but police militarized with weapons of war, as if the populations need to be repressed militarily. So could you elaborate on those ideas?
Absolutely. There's a frothing controversy around the country about not just, and I'll focus on a couple of different parts of the process. The first part is just the procurement of military weapons and technology by police departments. And you could describe that as basically weapons contractors looking for new markets, right? And having already sold to the Defense Department and having already, you know, for all intents and purposes, conquered the globe and established Pax Americana, right? We are now looking for new markets to sell weapons, and where better to look than the public safety agencies within the United States, which now means that we Americans confront, deployed against us, tools that were developed by the military to use in foreign theaters. Tools like, for instance, stingrays are a good example. These are surveillance tools used by local police to monitor cell phone networks. Surveillance drones are another example of a military technology, a spying technology that was developed for use abroad and then found expanding uses, a mission creep, not unlike SWAT teams, leading them straight to the U.S., where they're now deployed around the country in U.S. cities.
And Shahid, this is part of the Pentagon's 1033 program.
That's exactly right. There's a bill in Congress. Representative Hank Johnson, if I remember correctly, from Georgia, has a bill to restrain the 1033 program and subject it to some greater process limits. The ultimate question here, though, is why are police departments allowed to buy military weapons in the first place, right? That's not terribly consistent with a free society, and it's perfectly encapsulated within Eisenhower's very prescient warning. If anybody remembered what the U.S. president told us would happen in 1961, it might help us better connect the dots across these seemingly disparate struggles to recognize the way in which there is a military-industrial complex, a meta-institutional complex, which through the FBI, through the CIA, through different programs, whether it's hacking the Senate, whether it's torturing people, whether it's compelling a Democratic administration to resign the international law that requires it to prosecute known abuses, whether it's mass surveillance, targeted surveillance like COINTELPRO, or the street-level surveillance like stingrays and surveillance drones to which we're subjected. These are all different dimensions of the assault on our democratic rights, liberties, and processes. And that's exactly, again, what the creator of the military-industrial complex warned us would happen. And I particularly wish that policymakers would understand that legacy, because as we're talking about the street-level surveillance, in particular local police militarization, that's a set of issues that you don't need Congress to fix. Local city councils and state legislatures direct local police. And if state and local policymakers better understood the context in which they operate, the co-optation of Congress, the subversion of transparency through executive secrecy, the resignation of judicial independence, there would be, I think, greater opportunities to do something about what I said and to start recovering some of those rights and liberties that particularly at the local level are being taken from us.
Shahid Buttar, there's another chapter in Censored 2017 all on the mighty Wurlitzer, the press, the CIA, and subversion of truth by Brian Covert that talks about the CIA control of the media, yet another element and aspect attacking our free press and democracy. And Carl Bernstein really broke one of those stories in 1977 and cited over 400 journalists having worked in one way or another for the CIA. And we've certainly learned much more about the CIA involvement in media. And again, these aren't conspiracy theories. These are things that have been well documented, as you point out, of the many documented instances of the police state and apparatus working both before and after the events of 9/11.
I think the distinction between the narratives spun by corporate media versus the truths that are revealed and depicted by independent media and whistleblowers and, you know, people who resign their careers to let the public know about facts like Edward Snowden, for instance, facts we should know about. If our free media was particularly dedicated to anything resembling truth or reason, your program would be on national networks, right?
Yeah.
those are the kinds of issues that we deal with, I think, is the misinformation and disinformation lead to an uninformed electorate willing to make, quite frankly, stupid decisions. And, you know, the idea, for instance, that for the last 15 years, police and intelligence agencies have basically held political trump cards that would overwhelm any concern about constitutional rights, all of that is grounded in an executive secrecy that precludes real debate, right? Members of Congress next year are going to be called on to either allow to expire or reauthorize a law that is a crux of the NSA dragnet, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which incidentally Congress imposed after it discovered the COINTELPRO era. When Congress examines that next year, the American public that will be watching will have been informed by a whole series of lies, essentially. Lies, for instance, like this program keeps us safe, or lies like this program doesn't offend constitutional values, or lies like this program is actually subject to oversight, or there are internal controls, or lies like whistleblowers have the rights to bring their concerns forward without being viciously retaliated against. All those kinds of lies, which are buttressed by false corporate media depictions of these underlying events, skew the political debate both in the institutions and in our culture. And it leads us, I fear, to a dumber future, and perhaps one in which we have fewer freedoms and are subject to more control.
Indeed, and it seems when you mentioned the Trump card, perhaps the pun was intended, and we're possibly seeing some of the results of this misinformed, disinformed public in the current election cycle. We're speaking with Shahid Batar. He is a contributor to Censored 2017. He wrote a chapter called Ike's Dystopian Dream and How It Came True. We'll continue our conversation with Shahid Batar after this musical break. Stay with us.
The NSA breaks the law every day. It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. They monitor your phone calls and emails anyway. Corrupt Congress, of course, paving the way. There's a lesson you'll learn someday. Watch what you say. See, they spy on your mind, record your calls for posterity, commit daily executive crimes with impunity. For the authorities here to keep us safe until the boot ends up on your face. Against the Constitution, we the people are the ones our government is abusing. We can force any agency to make a new choice when we build a movement, each raising our voice. They lie about the origins of the evidence. They lie about the numbers of Americans watched. Immense, too large for them to calculate, they cite. A self-serving lie by the government side. Computing power unmatched in history. Presuming the power to wiretap humanity. It's insanity how large the human is. The government's watching you in the bathroom. And they lie about it at every opportunity. Sustained abuses of every community. Unity across Washington, D.C. All three branches against the people we see. Bush signed a secret presidential decree. Obama talked a big game. From presidentially did everything he could to entrench the Bush legacy. A complex composed of military industry. Eisenhower 60 years before anticipated it'd be rising in the ranks for generations. Growing a crisis in democracy, sowing the futures at stake. You could start by knowing. It's the NSA against the Constitution. We the people are the ones our government is abusing. We can force any agency to make a new choice when we build a movement, each raising our voice. 100 years since World War I, the FBI versus free speech has held a gun. Constitutional rights on the run. The Palmer raised the first, but not the last one. Fast forward 40 years to the real Red Scare. McCarthy didn't number, but the FBI was there. They were everywhere. They knew it. You were to bed. They prosecuted people for the thoughts in our heads.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Shahid Batar for this segment of the program. He's a constitutional lawyer. Also, he was the leader of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee from 2009 to 2015. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee does some fantastic work. So if you're unfamiliar with their work, bordc.org is the website. Shahid Batar is now with Electronic Frontier Foundation. In his individual capacity, he contributed a chapter to Censored 2017, Ike's Dystopian Dream and How It Came True. We blew by 1033s, and perhaps some listeners don't know or understand exactly what that is. Could you briefly talk about what that means?
The 1033 program is a program through which the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security make available to local police departments used or outdated military weapons and surveillance technology, crowd control devices, training programs, and I'd imagine in some cases opportunities to travel to conferences and such. Examples come to mind like the Urban Area Security Initiative, which I know in the Bay Area, the Stop Urban Shield Coalition has been very concerned about and active in resisting. These programs basically enable police to, for instance, buy armored personnel carriers or surveillance drones or participate in trainings that have been found recently to promote a shoot first and ask questions later mentality among cops. The same sort of mentality you might expect among soldiers, but not that you would want among police, who are dedicated supposedly to protecting and serving as opposed to paint a target on it and destroy it. There is a very crucial distinction between domestic policing functions and military functions. that distinction is being eroded by local police not only attaining the weaponry and the tools of their military counterparts, but then also the training that then encourages them to act militaristically to resolve conflicts through force. To, for instance, we've heard this story all too many times where in dealing with someone with a mental health problem, police instead treat someone in that situation as a violent criminal and someone ends up unnecessarily dead at the end of it. Those are all causes and effects of police militarization. And it's a result. Not only are we being spied on by our federal government when we use the internet or the phone system, but we're also being spied on by our local police departments and state highway patrols and other state and local agencies when we simply walk down the street. Closed circuit television cameras are the most overt, but then there's all kinds of ways from, we talked before about stingrays and MC catchers, tools that spy on cell phone networks, the city of Baltimore, and who knows what other cities around the country have been subjected to persistent aerial surveillance, basically having airplanes in the air with high-resolution cameras, literally watching everything in the city all the time for months at a time without judicial warrants or any oversight. These are the kinds of ways in which our liberties are being impacted by the military-industrial complex of which President Eisenhower warned us.
Shahid, explain to people a little bit about Stingray and how that works electronically, but then also let's talk about stop and frisk.
Sure. Stingrays, let's start there. It's a very timely issue, even though, ironically, we are about, I suppose, 13 years behind the ball here. So the first known deployment of these tools, and again, they basically mimic a cell phone tower so that when your phone thinks it's connecting to the cell tower for your network to then, for instance, place a call or access the internet, what it's actually communicating with to get to the internet or the voice network is a police device mimicking the cell phone tower. We know that these devices have been and are still being used in the context of suppressing peaceful demonstrations. The first known deployment of them, as far as I know, was in 2003 in a protest in which I participated in Miami opposing the Free Trade Area of the Americas, sort of like the precursor to the contemporary TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. So these devices, Stingrays, MC catchers, they allow police not only to track locations of known people, but then also to conduct surveillance of metadata and potentially content coming through those tools. Here's the part I want to focus on. Nobody knew they existed until a jailhouse lawyer, someone defending themselves from a criminal conviction, discovered an accidental reference to a stingray in a court document. That was almost 10 years after these devices were first used against American people in secret by militarized local police deploying military technology against us. Again, a perfect example of what Ike was talking about. But the part about stingrays I find most offensive is the secrecy that precluded debate about, for instance, should you require a warrant before you use one of these? And of course the answer is yes, but nobody knew these things were being used. And so the first time that a federal court required a warrant for stingray use was this year in 2016. The Department of Justice in 2015 conceded that federal agencies have to obtain a judicial warrant before deploying a stingray, but around the country, state and local agencies in most states are subject to no such restriction. In Baltimore and Maryland, stingrays were used in that city alone thousands of times in the late 2000s without any judicial or legislative oversight. States are now starting to respond. California has a good law in place. The strongest law in the country regulating stingrays is actually in Illinois, where the state enacted a law this year not only requiring police to obtain a warrant before using stingrays, but also providing a suppression remedy so that someone who is accused of a crime and confronting evidence gathered from a stingray can exclude that evidence from a criminal prosecution because it was obtained illegally. It also, and this is an important point to consider, prohibits the latest versions of the device. Everything that we've been describing, the monitoring, cell phone networks, the tracking location, that was what they could do back in 2003. The newer versions of the devices can hack a phone, plant malware on a phone, deny service to a phone. They're very, very sophisticated. And the Illinois law uniquely says that police may not use, even with the judicial order, a stingray or MC catcher to conduct those kinds of offensive hacking operations. And that's a big deal that, quite frankly, most states, including California, have yet to address.
Shahid Buttar, we have a few minutes left in this segment, and you conclude your contribution to Censored 2017 this year in your chapter. What to expect? The scheduled expiration in 2017 of FISA Section 702, that's then the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act?
It's a bill that originally was passed to limit domestic spying, to end the kinds of abuses that Congress caught the FBI conducting during the COINTELPRO era, when they were hunting political activists and trying to neutralize figures like Dr. King. When 702 was amended in 2008, it was basically changed by Congress to permit much of what it was originally passed to prohibit. This was actually quite controversial when then-Senator Obama was running for the White House and pledged at one point to filibuster the law that released the agencies from their prior limits, and then ended up voting for it, saying that as a president, he would rein in those abuses, which unfortunately he hasn't done. Much like we were just talking about stingrays and the executive secrecy that precluded debate, everything related to 702 has been secret. The only reason we know anything about it is because of a whistleblower who is effectively exiled from the country at the moment, Edward Snowden. And Congress has not dealt with any aspect of the 702 abuses. This law enables programs including PRISM and Upstream Collection, which enable the government to collect, I don't want to say everything, but essentially everything. This is untethered data collection from the internet without any individual suspicion. We're talking about metadata of communications, content of communications, associations, anything on the cloud basically is vulnerable to the government because Section 702 gave the government the right to essentially co-opt the internet as a surveillance tool. And the scheduled expiration of 702 could take offline some of those programs. It also could be a point at which Congress is compelled by public attention and controversy to impose long overdue limits on the agencies to restore the constitutional rights that are undermined when intelligence agencies are allowed to conduct mass surveillance. And mass surveillance, like police militarization, have historically been defining cornerstones of authoritarianism. If a country has militarized police, or if they have a controlled media, or if they have mass surveillance, all of which we have in the United States, they would be described as unfree, and yet we claim freedom falsely as a defining national value. And at the end of the day, those are the issues at stake here. People think about these issues as if they relate to public safety, or as if they relate, for instance, to national security. They don't at all. They relate to the question of whether or not we will live in a free society, or whether instead we will live in one in which we are controlled.
Shahid Buttar, your contribution to Censored 2017 was Ike's dystopian dream and how it came true, and you conclude by saying we have a great deal to learn from President Eisenhower. Ike told us to take nothing for granted while warning the people of the United States not to let our guardians turn their sights on us. And of course, you are talking about how that's exactly what has happened, and certainly we need to stay vigilant in the future while these programs are continued or whether they are sought to for reauthorization. Shahid Buttar, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today and for the contribution in Censored 2017, our book. Could you tell people a website so they could follow more of your work?
I write very frequently for EFF.org, and I have all of my work collected at shahidbuttar.com.
Shahid Buttar, thanks so much for joining us today. We look forward to catching up with you again in the near future.
Thanks, Mickey.
Coming up next on the Project Censored show, I'll be speaking with co-host Dr. Peter Phillips about his contribution to Censored 2017, which is a chapter that looks in depth at what's referred to as public relations propaganda, firms in service to the transnational capitalist class. Please stay with us.
It's an art that deserves gold. After story. and now you see the light. You stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up.
Jab, jab.
Stand up for your rights.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of today's program, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Peter Phillips. He has contributed another chapter to the Project Censored annual books, this year's Censored 2017 40th Anniversary Edition. And his chapter in the book is Selling Empire, War, and Capitalism, Public Relations Propaganda Firms in Service to the Transnational Capitalist Class. This is based on a lot of the research that Peter's been doing the last several years on what he calls the transnational capitalist class. And again, just a reminder, Peter is not only co-host here at the Project Censored Show, he's a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University. He's president of the Media Freedom Foundation, Project Censored, and has done numerous books, 14 censored books, among others. And he's going to talk to us about this growing concern about public relations firms as propaganda in service to the transnational capitalist class. Peter.
Thank you, Mickey. It's great to be included in the Censored 2017 book. I'd like to say one thing about Censor 2017. You know, the first 100 pages is the top 25 stories. And then there's another book inside, 300 pages long, that encompasses many of the people we've been talking to, but also original research from the students at Sonoma State and myself. And this chapter about public relations firms, which we now call public relations and propaganda firms. The three largest ones we were able to research, my students, Raytona Coffey, Robert Ramirez, Mary Schaefer, and Nicole Tranchina, each took a firm and researched who their clients were. And so we've developed for the first time these massive firms, WPP, Omnicom, Interpublic Group. These firms are in literally every country in the world. 215,000 employees collectively, $35 billion a year in revenue. They do things that we now know, like WPP, Helen Nolan. They were the ones that formed the Council for Tobacco Research back in 1954 to counter Reader Digest report on tobacco being linked to cancer. So they were the longest running misinformation campaign in U.S. business history. Additionally, Bursa Marcella was created a front group for Global Climate Coalition in 1989 to create doubt on global warming. And that was paid for by American Petroleum Institute, Chevron, Exxon, Ford, Shell, GM, and Texaco. They were also the front group for Californians for Realistic Vehicle Standards in 1998 to oppose restrictions on car emissions. So these PR firms are engaged in not only selling products, but in publicly manipulating what we understand and know about. They do brand enhancement, of course, but their biggest brands are tobacco, alcohol, sugar and sweet junk food, pharmaceutical products, and they're massive. They're global kinds of things, and they're not afraid to lie. We know that Helen Nolan under WPP was the one that was hired by Citizens for a Free Kuwait. That's what they created, this front group. And they were the ones that brought before Congress a young woman named Nayira, who went to Congress, this is before the invasion of Iraq the first time, and cried in front of Congress saying that Iraqi soldiers came into the hospital with guns and went to the room where the babies were in incubators and dumped them out. And she said that she was a nurse there that day. Well, that wasn't true. She was the daughter of the Kuwait ambassador to the U.S., and she was trained by Helen Nolan to lie. These are ongoing things. I mean, in fact, Omnicom's public relations firm Ketchum was recently hired by the Honduras government to whitewash their human rights record and the coup in 2009. So they provide crisis management for Honduras and run front groups in terms of support. So these are ongoing propaganda campaigns that are initiated by these companies. And Omnicom has over 200 subsidiaries, 74,000 employees. And we went online, and this is what took the students so long. They went to every single one of the agencies and searched their websites to determine who their clients were. They would like to brag about their clients. So we have put together in this book for the first time ever, at least it's a partial list of all the clients that Omnicom has and WPP and Interpublic Group. But I want to read to you some of the clients that Omnicom has. They're governments.
And this is a vast list. And
oh,
this
it's
is
huge.
Why
I'm going to read a little bits of it here. But in terms of governments, they represent Canada, Brazil, China, Colombia, Congo, Dubai, UNICEF, the United Nations, Ecuador, Egypt, Georgia, the country, Mexico, Nicaragua, Nigeria, Peru, Portugal, Qatar, New York Police Department, City of Brooklyn, the California Lottery, the Veterans Affairs Office. That's just some of the governments they represent. They also do nonprofit organizations like the American Petroleum Institute, the American Red Cross, the Ad Council, Doctors Without Borders, the Council of Foreign Relations, one of the strongest policy groups in the world, the Democratic Governors, the Doctors Without Borders, Ford Foundation, Kaiser, the National Hockey League, Rockefeller Foundation, Salvation Army, the United Nations Education Fund, the University of California, Berkeley. That's just part list of who they are. But then they also do brands. So they do 7-Eleven, 7-Up, Apple, Bank of America, Bacardi, Barnes & Noble, Chevrolet, Philips, Cisco, Citibank, Chase Bank, Clorox, Coca-Cola is a big one for everybody there. And certainly Exxon, Facebook, FedEx, Ford, Heineken, IBM, Jack Daniels and Harley-Davidson, Levi's, Miller Coors, Mercedes-Benz, NBC, Procter & Gamble, PlayStation and Pizza Hut and Sony and Smirnoff and Wells Fargo, Toyota, Walt Disney, Whole Foods. I mean, this is just a small listing,
Peter,
of the many
would...
thousands of products and clients that they have worldwide. They are not only in the business of selling product, but they're selling ideas as well.
Indeed, it would take less time to say who's not involved here. And this is, again, an exhaustive chapter research, Chapter 7 in Censor 2017, Selling Empire, War, and Capitalism, Public Relations Propaganda Firms and Service to the Transnational Capitalist Class. And Peter, you did this with research support from Sonoma State University students, Ratanya Coffey, Robert Ramirez, Mary Schaefer, and Nicole Tranchina. These are the students that helped research this. And I want to come back and kind of big picture this because of what you just read to us and said. You start the chapter by talking about Edward Bernays, right? The great public relations master of propaganda, in fact, of the 20th century, got a start in the Creel Commission in World War I and lived a long life doing what he called engineering of consent, right? And Bernays had written here, "It is impossible to overstate the importance of engineering consent. It affects almost every aspect of our daily lives. When used for social purposes, it is among our most valuable contributions to the efficient functioning of society. But the techniques can be subverted. Demagogues can utilize them for anti-democratic purposes as successfully as those who employ them for socially desirable ends." You mentioned the Hill and Knowlton case, right? But also the CIA is involved in this with media manipulation. So there's a long history of this, whether the CIA is involved through films from the Green Berets to Zero Dark Thirty or a manipulation of newsrooms. And there's another chapter in that in Project Censored. Can you talk about some of those different angles?
Well, certainly the CIA has been mandated not to pay for journalism services in the United States, but they can do that internationally, of course, and do. But in addition, they will use someone like Hill and Knowlton, who have worldwide offices, to do press releases for them. And so Hill and Knowlton has contacts inside of every major media group in the world, and will make sure that those CIA press releases, not labeled that way, are included. You know, Ben Bagdikian told me 15 years ago that when he was in the Washington Post, two-thirds of the time, the stories were originating with public relations firms or press releases from PR people in government. Now the research shows that's closer to 80%. So all of corporate media, literally 80% of the stories we see on television, in the newspaper, originate from a PR professional, either in a private firm or in government. So it's managed news. It's top-down control. This is what they want us to hear. And this PR industry is highly concentrated. It's global. And the primary goal here, we have to think about this, is a promotion of capital growth through hegemonic psychological control of human desires, emotions, beliefs, and values. And they do this by manipulating our feelings and our cognitions of people worldwide. So that's even the people that live on $3 a day. They're trying to convince them to buy a Coca-Cola and a cigarette. They're the key component of helping the transnational capitalist class continue to grow and concentrate wealth. They're the ideological engine of capitalism, with their massive influence in the world, corporate media, and an increasing embeddedness with government propaganda, including the psychological operations to support a permanent war on terror.
Indeed. Peter Phillips, I wanted to share with listeners just a brief segment of this chapter that specifically looks at the Central Intelligence Agency. And you cite Johann Carlyle, who was Covert Action Quarterly author, and talks about former CIA official Robert Crowley, the agency's longtime liaison with corporation, acknowledged that, quote, Hill and Knowlton's overseas offices were perfect cover for the ever-expanding CIA. Unlike other cover jobs, being a public relations specialist did not require technical training for CIA officers. Furthermore, the CIA, Crowley admitted, used Hill and Knowlton connections to, quote, put out press releases and make media contacts to further its positions. Hill and Knowlton employees at the small Washington office and elsewhere distributed the material through CIA assets working in the U.S. news media. In fact, Carlyle emphasizes, and this is a great quote, since the CIA is prohibited, you said this, right? They're prohibited from disseminating propaganda inside the United States, but this is a kind of blowback, right? And so CIA officer John Stockwell and other researchers have talked about this, and they've traced this to the agency. And again, this has the effect of being an illegal kind of propaganda campaign. This quote goes on to say, while the use of U.S. media by the CIA has a long and well-documented history, the covert involvement of PR firms may be news to many. And your chapter really kind of exposes the ubiquity of these PR firms worldwide.
And there's resistance happening. So like Quebec is one of the first states in the world to ban commercial advertising to children under the age of 13. And, you know, three generations of people in Cuba have grown up without product advertising in their lives. I was down there 4 years ago with a group of graduate students from the University of Havana, and I asked them, did you ever want a Happy Meal? And they just laughed. They thought it was absolutely absurd to even consider the idea. So we have to be thinking about the absurdity of this public relations propaganda industry and be taking greater steps to restrict it from our lives and our culture.
Indeed. This, again, is a contribution to Censored 2017. It's Selling Empire, War, and Capitalism, Public Relations Propaganda Firms in Service to the Transnational Capitalist Class. Peter Phillips, is there anything else you'd like to add about your research or the strain of research from which this came, or anything else about this chapter you want to share with people?
One recent understanding that I came, you know, is this idea that we may have to intervene in Aleppo as a humanitarian intervention.
And in that, Syria.
In Syria. And
I say that because the libertarian candidate Gary Johnson said, "What's Aleppo?" So we want to make sure our listeners know that we're not any Gary Johnson over here.
But the propaganda on this intervention is being managed by a public relations firm, Avaaz, to try to promote, is paid for by USAID, and they're the ones doing social media to say how awful this is and how we have to intervene. It's a humanitarian thing. And this is really, you know, saber-rattling relative to Russia, and they're very upset about that. So it's ongoing. It's in our news every day, and we often don't know the sources for this information.
We've been talking about Peter Phillips' contribution to Censored 2017 on Selling Empire, War, and Capitalism. After this brief musical break, we'll be back to talk about the rest of Censored 2017. Stay with us. Thank you.
last segment of our show today, we're going to look overall at the new release of Censored 2017, the 40th anniversary of Project Censored's books. This book is edited by Mickey Huff and Andy Lee Roth, with a foreword by Mark Crispin Miller, and the cartoons, of course, by Khalil Bendib. It has a beautiful cover of many prior Project Censored books that we're thankful to the Seven Stories Press, and we are the winner of the 2014 Pilar Award for New Media and Journalism. So that's an exceptional thing as well. And I'm going to be talking with Mickey here today about the book. And I had said earlier, and I think it's really important to understand, that this is a 450-page book. The first 100 pages are the top censored stories, the top 25. And those will be appearing in 18 cities on alternative news weeklies very soon all over the country. And many people think, well, that's what Project Censored does. But every year we really write another book. It's a book inside a book, which has 7-8 chapters on various media analysis circumstances that are really important to the world and very contemporary and very current research. So, Mickey, talk to us about what else is in the book besides the top 25 stories.
Yeah, I would like to do that, Peter. You know, when I became the director of the project back in 2010, that's when you and I were expanding the project through the Campus Affiliates Program and really kind of spreading the great work that you did with the project since you took it on in 1996, 97. That's after the first 20 years, after founded by Carl Jensen. And so the project was certainly known for its top 25. And by the way, I just wanted to give a quick thanks to James Preston Allen at Random Length News this year, who put together a few stories for us that are going out in the weeklies and that are going to be out in maybe a lot of the cities where the show plays, Project Censored shows on 35 stations. People can certainly learn about the list, but there's so much more going on, Peter, and I really find your sort of visual, the book inside of a book, that's really an apt way to describe what happens here in the 450 pages of Censored 2017, is that we not only do the top 25, but we do what's called deja vu. We go back and look at previously censored or underreported stories, and if they've gotten any coverage, seen the light of day, or do they continue to languish in obscurity, which unfortunately many do. And Mark Crispin Miller in the foreword about our so-called free press talks about so many examples of how the free press fails in the United States because it's dominated by deep state and corporate private profit interests. But this year, we went back and looked at Strolling Down Memory Hole Lane. Our 28 international judges at Project Censored went back and selected their top stories over 40 years. This is the 40th anniversary of Project Censored. And they went back and selected their favorite top stories. And that's what we talk about in Chapter 2. Again, just think about some of these stories when you're looking at the top 25 or when you're looking at things that are covered and not covered in corporate media. And for the deja vu, we covered the myth of black progress. That was in 1977 that story was being covered. And certainly here we are in the present with Black Lives Matter and the violence and police brutality against unarmed African-American men. Some of these stories don't go away and they have a lot of historical roots and context, but often that context is lost and is not reported in corporate media. We also looked at corporate crimes from 1979 and 2000. We looked at wealth inequality over a 10-year period from 2005 to 16, 11 years. We also look at information monopoly, and this year's book was dedicated to the late Ben Bagdikian, who did Media Monopoly, and this looks at the media consolidation in the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and now today we have only 6 corporations to control the media in the United States. We took a look back at the suspension of habeas corpus and also the continued concerns for climate change, and that is just chapter 2 of the book. So, Peter, when you talk about the book within a book, it really is an exhaustive research process, and this year we're talking about over 230 students, over 30 faculty, 18 to 20 colleges and universities around the United States, and Project Censored has, as part of its mission, not just fighting against censorship, which we define as anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have a free press system or structure, but we also are big advocates of what's called critical media literacy education, so we can teach people how to understand understand media, how to deconstruct propaganda, and how to join in our fight for media freedom and media democracy. And so there are so many other things in the book that help do that, especially the junk food news abuse work that's done every year on the sort of garbage and sensationalist and titillating material that just floods the airwaves all year long. This year, we looked specifically at the primaries and election process, which has been a spectacle indeed, which reminds me of, you know, Neil Postman in 1985 said the United States was the most entertained, least informed society in the world. And we've certainly continued that trajectory in many ways. But yeah, Peter, and of course, we also include your research. You were director for some 14 years. You continue to do excellent work on the power elites. And each year we have work from you. Brian Covert continues to do fantastic work. This year he did a chapter for us on CIA media connections played by the mighty Wurlitzer. You know, previously Covert did a fantastic chapter on Gary Webb, the Dark Alliance. And actually, Peter, Project Censored was responsible for helping that story along.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The story of Gary Webb and the CIA crack cocaine connection. That's right when you came in to Project Censored.
Very close. And Gary was out there doing that. And we connected him with Seven Stories Press, which ended up publishing his book, which documents quite clearly that the CIA was, in fact, fully aware that drugs were being delivered to Los Angeles and San Francisco and profits were going back to support the Contras.
Actually, that story, too, not only did Seven Stories Press then publish that, but it subsequently became a screenplay by Nick Scow, who we've had on the program, his last book on CIA media called Spooked on David Talbot's Hot Books. We had him on the show not long ago, but that was actually the film Killing the Messenger. That message is still trying to get out and see the light of day, how the CIA not only manipulates media, but how the CIA was involved in these crimes, and a journalist that exposed it, his career was ruined. And Webb ended up committing suicide after a long time of being blacklisted and kept out of media. You know, this is the price that journalists and whistleblowers pay when they speak truth to power, because speaking truth is power. And those are the kind of stories, by the way, that we highlight every year in Project Censored. You know, we do the critical. We talk about what's wrong with the media in the United States, but we also do the affirmative. My associate director, Andy Lee Roth, always likes to say, we also highlight the great work of intrepid journalists and independent journalists that really tell people what's going on in society. And our first chapter really celebrates that, but the subsequent chapters are longer, in-depth studies.
Chapter 4, Media Democracy in Action, lays out positive steps by a variety of different people, including Peter B. Collins, Eric Dreister, Abby Martin, and a number of others that are giving the public independent news and news sources on a regular, often daily basis.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what this 40th anniversary celebration of Project Censored is about. It's actually not about Project Censored. It's about the mission of Project Censored. It's about critical media literacy education. It's about decoding and deconstructing propaganda and understanding misinformation and disinformation. It's about all of these kinds of things. Like you said, Peter, it's a community effort. It's a collaborative effort. And, you know, we want to make sure that we're all reaching across whatever divides there are, whatever historical divides that have been created in the U.S., whether it's racial divides, gender divides, sexual orientation divides, generational divides. We need to break down the divides, and we need to come together against what we face. We face a massive corporate, deep state, hegemonic control over information, over our economy, over the globe. You talk about that in the transnational capital class, and in general, we talk about that at Project Censored when we look at the chapters in the book. And again, you mentioned the book within the book. So we at Project Censored over the years have never shied away from controversial issues or subjects. And again, this year, we tackle the very difficult research area that is off-targeted, where people do controversial research. They're called conspiracy theorists. We have a fantastic chapter by PhD librarian and researcher Susan Merritt, Secrecy in Society Journal. She is a fantastic researcher. Her chapter is Contested Visions, Imperfect Information and the Persistence of Conspiracy Theories, where she lays out a detailed way of how we can better deal with complicated issues. You know, she cites historian Catherine Olmsted at UC Davis, who offers a more contemporary view of suspicion and conspiracies, one that's compatible with her overall discussion, where Olmsted states, quote, "More often, however, the culture of suspicion created by revelations of government conspiracies undermines democracy. When citizens cannot trust their government to tell the truth, when they are convinced the public officials routinely conspire, lie, and conceal their crimes, they become less likely to trust the government to do anything. The result is a profoundly weakened polity with fewer citizens voting and more problems left unaddressed for a future generation that is ever more cynical about the possibility of reforms." You know, this is another reason why we do celebrate millennial generation. These are the people behind Occupy Wall Street. These are the people behind the Dreamers. These are the people behind Black Lives Matter. And we want to celebrate these pro-democracy movements and these pro-equality movements and these social justice movements. And that's another thing that we really look at in the censored books. We also look in detail at the surveillance culture. But let's not forget this, folks. You know, I hope Oliver Stone's film Snowden really reminds people about the significance of what those revelations were, those whistleblowing revelations of the NSA ubiquitous spying. The great Elliot Cohen, I have to say it. Hats off to Elliot Cohen. He has a chapter in our book for several years running on these key issues. His chapter, Remote Control, Electronic Surveillance and the Demise of Human Dignity, is just an amazing look at what goes on with surveillance and how it affects humanity and society.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn to global economy.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To find out how you can get the program airing in your local community radio station, you can contact us through projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Extra special thanks goes to our producer, Anthony Fest, and also our engineer, Erica Bridgman. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. Hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.